You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to my guest, Terry Pease. Terry shares with us a story that starts with online dating, with somebody who was very honest in their dating profile. I'm not an expert in online dating, but I've heard many a tale that make me think that honesty in creating your online dating profile might not be the most common thing to happen. She went out on a first date with a man who had Parkinson's disease. They fell in love and they built a life together. And in this episode, we talk about making the decision to build a life with somebody who has a terminal disease. For some people, this might be a gloomy and tough discussion, but Terry shares some beautiful and loving stories. And I think that overall, this is an uplifting and helpful interview. Before we started, sometimes I talk a little bit with the guests before we hit record. And Terry asked me about the audience of the show because she normally is in a spot where she's speaking to people who are already caregivers of loved ones with Parkinson's disease. And I shared with her what I'm going to share with you now, that the audience of the Imperfect Adulting Show, which is you guys listening and watching, crosses over a variety of age groups and is demographically agnostic on purpose. That was part of my idea behind the show. And one of the reasons is that I have this idea that I think that the best time to hear about things is long before we might ever even know that we would run into that situation. So the best time to hear from somebody who is caregiving or has been a caregiver for somebody with Parkinson's disease is long before you might ever know that you would have to navigate any of those obstacles. So enough about me and my thoughts about this. Let's get to the interview. Welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. Terry Pease, are you ready for a fun chat today?
I am. I'm excited.
I love it. All right. I start all of my conversations asking my guests what part of the world you call home. So where are you?
I'm in southern Maine in a small town called Yarmouth, Maine.
Beautiful. It's probably cold up there these right about now.
Cold and snowy.
That's winter. All right. So one more warm-up question. What is one way that art or beauty shows up in your life?
I am a fan of opera.
I love it.
Excuse me.
That's good. So I am a fan of opera in concept and in short doses. But when I was a young mom, inspired by the MasterCard commercial that where the couple went to the opera in the ad, I did season tickets with my husband for 2 years in the opera. And I learned that as a tired young mom, opera was not a good fit for me. Exactly. I fell asleep. It was a great nap. It was a wonderful nap in a pretty dress. All right. So, which is not a thing about opera. It's a thing about being tired and late night activities. All right. So the topic today is not actually opera, but we are going to talk about loving somebody with Parkinson's disease. Are you ready to talk with me about that today?
I certainly am. Yes.
Oh, thank you, Terry. All right. So we are going to talk about your relationship with your husband. This is the first conversation that you and I have had, and this means that I don't know very much yet. I'm going to ask a little bit of just getting started, personal stuff, background information. If I get too personal, I don't think I will, but if I do, you just tell me and I'm going to back off. All right. Okay. So how did you meet your husband?
Well, I met my husband at the opera.
Oh, I love it.
All right, we actually met online, but our first date was at the Lyric Opera in Chicago. And it was a theme in our relationship.
Beautiful, beautiful. So you met online, first date at the opera. Were you guys located? So you met online. Were you in the same geographic location when you started dating, or was this a long distance relationship?
Oh, yes and no. Chicago is a very big city, and I lived at one end of the city, and he lived in a suburb in the other end of the city. So even though we would say Chicagoland, it was still far enough that it was noticeable. But yeah.
All right. Very good. So at what point in this process Did you find out or learn that the person you were dating or that you were married to had Parkinson's disease?
That was in his notification on the dating site. So I saw this intriguing man. Photo was interesting. Story was interesting. He was a beautiful writer, and he had Parkinson's and a 12-year-old daughter.
All right. So it was in his
I
dating
knew from the
profile. It was
beginning.
from the very, very beginning. So then, at that point, when you were online dating and just exploring new people and all of those things, what awareness and knowledge did you have, if any, about Parkinson's disease?
Very little. What I knew was what most people know, that tremor is a factor that they have. People with Parkinson's have trouble walking, and they have trouble with balance, and they have tremors. And that's what I knew.
All
And that's really
right.
all I knew.
So I'm from that point, I'm going to ask you to share with us, because now today you know probably a lot more. And I know you're not a doctor or an expert. Many people who are listening will have some exposure to Parkinson's disease. I, as a host, try not to assume that everybody in the audience knows what I know or what you know. And so I thought I'd like to take the chance and the opportunity to bring us all to the same page. Would you mind or would you be kind enough to share a brief explanation of what Parkinson's, too many syllables there. Parkinson's disease is for anybody in the audience who doesn't already know.
I'm happy to do that. And most people who have not encountered the disease directly know what I knew: shaky feet, shaky tremors, sticky feet, fall risks, and stiffness. And that's about what the public vision is. That's changed a little bit since Michael J. Fox has become the pub and Muhammad Ali and others have become the public face of Parkinson's. But even their stories are very different. And one thing to know right away about Parkinson's is that it is not a straight line predictable disease. And so the doctors say, when you've seen one case of Parkinson's, you've seen one.
Okay.
It is the most, what is the fastest growing neurodegenerative disease in the world. It is common in the United States. About 100,000 new people a year develop get a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease. And what I didn't know, and what most people are not aware of, is that it involves behavioral and emotional interpersonal disruptions, and that it is a can be a very long story.
Okay, so neurodegenerative disease, that's the classification that we would use to lump it in if we were doing such a thing, which we should not, because as you said, there's a lot of variety between each person's experience, which I'm going to extrapolate means that for everybody who is in a situation like yours, loving someone with Parkinson's, that makes finding and sharing with community a more complex process, because everything is similar but different.
That's true. And so, what your neighbor knows about Parkinson's, well, my grandpa had Parkinson's and his was like this. You don't really have Parkinson's. And surprisingly, primary care doctors and general community doctors are not as familiar with Parkinson's as we wish they were, as caregivers wish they were. Parkinson's is not necessarily difficult to diagnose, and I'm not a physician, but there are some commonalities that help, are kind of like the hallmarks of the disease. There are no d blood tests for it,
Okay.
and yet a doctor does a clinical diagnosis. The management requires a great deal of specialized knowledge, and that can create a lot of frustrations for people with Parkinson's and for their caregivers.
So that experience that you described, where somebody in your social circle would try and align their experience with yours. That is one of the, that's one of the human frustrations of many situations. You hear that with grief, you hear that with parenthood, you hear that with, home decor, fitness, weight loss. We all do have a variety of experiences, and at some point we run into my philosophy, which is that, hey, listen, the only one who knows what it's like to be me is ever really going to be me. And so I try not to presume that I could ever understand what somebody else was experiencing. That's an impossible standard. That's an impossible standard, but it is something to be on the lookout for, I think, as we go through our lives, that we don't sort of hot topic and be like, oh, well, yeah, I know how you feel. It's like, do you? Do you
No.
really?
And yet, part of what has made my life so full in the years since my husband passed away is that creating a space where caregivers can talk to somebody else who can say, tell me your story. Mine is similar enough that I can be alongside you. I've lived much something much like that. And
Yes.
Parkinson's caregivers can be very lonely for a variety of reasons. And part of what is the hardest thing for Parkinson's caregivers, especially spouses, wives, and husbands, is that the person that you've lived your life with and who you may love deeply is, I love my husband to pieces. And yet Parkinson's steals away their capacity to connect with you. I
And
think
yeah, I
isolation
hear that. I
is.
hear that in other stories with Alzheimer's. That's a change in the relationship. I think it probably is, I would find that in other conversations also. I think I want to touch back on something you said, which I do think I want to make sure that we touch on the value of finding somebody with a shared experience is so supportive and helpful. And so it is. It's those two things. We never know exactly what somebody else is going through, but it is so helpful. Even in mundane things like finding people who have the same food preferences as you on vacation, or people who maintain early birds. Like I have a friend group that we get up early. It's very helpful. I can text them early in the morning and they're not annoyed. And so sure, finding people who have shared experience and the role of caregivers and the isolation of caregivers, I think that that is definitely something that probably has been going on since the beginning of time, but is absolutely receiving a lot more attention within maybe the last 10 or 15 years in the United States, alongside conversations like the sandwich generation, people have children and parents at the same time. And also the overall larger loneliness situation that has happened in the last, what, 5 to 7 years, exacerbated definitely by lockdown. But yes, finding the situation. And there's two, when we say caregivers, one of the things that is interesting is that this parallels a completely different situation, which is early, super early childhood caregiving, like young parents of very young children who are home and they have it's a temporary situation for most new parents because the child grows up. But also you've got somebody who's got a very specific set of needs that is takes a lot of work, and then you're by yourself a lot while you do that.
Very similar. And right. And the caregivers that I work with and interact with are very aware of the similarities to being a young parent, a young mother, usually in my community, and caring for a young child. But I think part of what is so demoralizing, well, there are two things that I think are really important. One is that when you are caring for a young child, in most cases, there's a whole culture
That's
of
right.
industry and a whole culture of expectations, which are sometimes good and sometimes overly demanding, but you're not feeling totally bewildered and uncertain about what this is. Even if you think you're supposed to be, this loving Madonna, and actually you're trying to tear your hair out with a kid who's being childlike. People often say caring for your partner who has Parkinson's is like caring for a 200-pound toddler. And that's hard.
That's very hard. And motherhood in the United States is celebrated, sometimes overly so, in a very romanticized version. But you do get societal reward for being a selfless mother. People honor it. Oh, you're so giving. Oh, you're so generous. And this is, such an important thing you do. Caregiving for parents and also I would say forever dependent children that grow up, adult dependent children, is almost invisible. It is not celebrated in the same way. It is not as publicly acknowledged. You're not, like you're missing that community. There's not a, baby massage group or a preschool roundup or any of those things that build the community. I think that there's similarities, but it's a very, I can see how the isolation would be different. And also, yeah, I don't know enough to, but yes, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing that I think is also difficult for caregivers of people who have Parkinson's disease or other kinds of conditions like that is that there's not even the expectation that someone should be available to help you. And I think that that is a relatively new thing in our culture. I remember reading about a community in, I think, West Africa. And in this village, there was a grandfather who had Parkinson's disease and was very disabled by it. But because this was a much more communal society where people lived around each other in a compound, it was not just the aged wife of an aged person with Parkinson's having to do everything.
That is a really important part and really important point. And I do think that that is a new phenomenon. I also think that that is something that we experience differently in the United States, maybe North America, than in some other cultures, because we have developed, I don't know when this started, but we have developed this sort of idea that sort of built around these 55 and older communities. And so we're grouping our communities by age group. And so you don't have the commune that includes preschool babies all the way up to seniors that are together all of the time. It's like we move, we move around. You were in Chicago, now you're in Maine. My in-laws were in New York. They moved to South Florida. It's a rite of passage this way. From Florida, sometimes we migrate back up to North Carolina. And I think that that's one of the draw that can be one of the drawbacks of those age group silos, which is, I don't know if that's bad or not, because I will say that my in-laws, when they moved into their active adult community at 55, they had the greatest time, and they really enjoyed it. So I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I would not be the person who gets to do this. Okay, so. All right, so you meet him, you date him, you know he has Parkinson's. In your guest pitch, you shared that neither of you could have predicted how Parkinson's disease would rob us of the life we had planned. And so I'm curious, I want to talk a little bit, if you can take us back to the beginning of this relationship. What kind of plans were you guys making?
Well, we made a lot of plans. I mean, as I said, opera was something that we just happened to be, this was a quirk. And so
Okay.
we had a lot of fun going to opera, going to theater, and that was a part of what we could do. But when my husband could no longer sit in a theater seat for, an extended time, we couldn't do that anymore. My husband had been a lifelong sailor of little open boats. That was his, he grew up in England and he had been sailing since he was 12 years old. And one of the things we also hit it off on was that we both loved Maine and we both loved to sail. And so what we did is we came to Maine to look for a house, the house that I'm in right now. Why we bought a three-story 19th century house, I'm not sure, but it was exactly the right house for us. And he climbed those stairs as long as we lived. He lived in this house. And we bought a sailboat. And we had so much fun finding it and getting it all put together and finding the sails and, all of that. And we never were able to sail her. We were
Okay.
one person. And so the image that we had of this late life marriage was stuff we wanted to do. And bit by bit, Parkinson's stole it all. My husband once said to me, "Parkinson's has stolen everything. I can't play tennis. I can't play the piano." He was a really engaged amateur pianist. "I can't play the piano." He rode horses. He had to get rid of his horses. He couldn't sail. And bit by bit by bit, many, many, many things were taken from him.
Okay.
Part
All
of what I
right.
learned as a caregiver is that if I could be clever enough and engaged enough and energetic enough, I could kind of scaffold him. And so for gardening, I did almost all the gardening, but it was done in such a way that it was as if we were doing it together. Does that make
Okay.
sense?
I think so. I've heard the term scaffolding used in other ways when we talk about things. I think the one of the places I've heard scaffolding used is when teaching somebody a new skill.
Exactly.
It's like designing a framework where it's supportive in a variety of different ways. And with education, you're talking about, until they can do it
Until they get
themselves.
their own, yes.
But you're saying redesigning and supporting so that your husband, who had restrictions and challenges, that he was still able to be a part of the process according to whatever he was able to do at the time.
As long as his judgment was functioning well, one of the hardest things, I'm going to say that 17 times, but another hard thing was that Parkinson's disrupts judgment.
Okay.
And so my husband, who was a woodworker and built lots of the wooden furniture in our house that was I still use, I'll never forget 4 o'clock in the morning, standing at the foot of a 4 foot ladder, watching my husband fix something, saying, "Don't you think it's time to go to bed? It's not safe to be up there." "I'm fine. I've been climbing ladders since before you were born," which is almost literally true. And yet, the exhaustion and the terror of guiding him and protecting his pride and his sense of who he really knew himself to be was terribly demanding.
It sounds very demanding, and I'm going to come back to that in a second. I want to reset, and I want to ask you, he was upfront about the fact that he had this condition from
Yes.
before you guys even talked. It was part of his online dating profile, which shows me that he's an honest person, and I think that's great. Because you hear the stories of online dating of people not being truthful about anything about them, their photo, their it's like famous, right? But he was being upfront. What was the for you at the start of this relationship, you had the information, but how was it showing up at the beginning when you guys did meet and just first started dating? So what was apparent, or was nothing very much apparent right at the start?
A few things were apparent pretty much at the start. This is a really trivial thing, but it was kind of evidence. I was able to see that the buttons on his shirt were held with Velcro behind the button.
Okay.
And you had to be kind of noticing for that. But of course, I was really there thinking, "You don't really want to do this, you know." And yet he was, I mean, everything about it was just right, except the fact that he had Parkinson's. And so I was trying to see, where does Parkinson's show up here? His
Yeah.
balance wasn't terrific. He didn't drive himself after dark, but lots of older folks, and we were older, don't drive themselves after dark. So the differences are subtle, and then they
Okay.
became less and less subtle.
And so, even though you knew, tell me, I'm going to make a summary statement, but if I'm way off base, just tell me. So, even though he was upfront and you saw the beginning symptoms, and you were probably learning as you went, was the experience and the progression surprising
Oh
to
yeah.
live through?
Oh
Okay.
yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, I was comfortable. I had, done work with adults with disabilities in a variety of kinds of ways, and I'd grown up with a blind couple who lived upstairs from us when I was a child. So I wasn't afraid of the fact that he had a disabling condition. I guess I would have named even that it's a disabling condition. But,
Sure.
we're all going to get older. Stuff is going to happen to us.
Yeah.
And he was kind of my guy. I mean, that was, I kept trying really hard not to get caught up with this guy, but he was my guy. And there were so many lovely things about him, and it was the right thing to do. But the surprises included the changes in judgment, loss of the ability to write. He wrote the most beautiful letters. He was very much a man of the 30s and 40s and 50s, and he wrote beautiful letters by hand until he couldn't anymore.
Yeah. And this dovetails with the universal experience. Like, so your husband had Parkinson's disease, and it's a very specialty circumstance, but all of us age. And so there is a loss of, some things as all of us age to some degree, which you were expecting and you had, experience with inclusion and differing abilities that you thought you were ready for, but this turned out to be different. And so I want to honor that. You mentioned that it was tough to manage all of these things. And one of the things you highlighted was his pride. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about that because I think that one of the things that is so interesting about helping people, and I do not have any experience helping anybody with Parkinson's, so I do not want to pretend that I do. But when helping people who are my age or similar ages or older try and make decisions, one of the things that sometimes I run into in my own family is sometimes I'm offering help or I feel like help is needed. The other person does not want help and actually does not want to even think about the concept of wanting help in that situation.
That's hard, and it's very common. I mean, one really clear example of that is the issue of driving. Parkinson's really undermines the person's ability to drive safely. And yet, when you say, "Dad, husband, let me drive this time," I'm fine. What do you think is wrong with me? And that drama can become very serious. And so, one of the things I do when I work with people is to find ways to ease into that reality without embarrassing the person. Another difficult thing is the fact that incontinence, I mean, in the Parkinson's community, we talk about anything and everything. And incontinence is a reality. Drooling is a reality. And how do you say to the husband that you love, it's time to wear absorbent underwear? We never say diapers if we can avoid it. But how do you say that to someone when you've cleaned up a wet bed week, night after night after night? And helping to sustain the person's dignity and pride is part of the reason I use the word dignity in the title of my book, because sustaining the person with Parkinson's, the dignity of the person with Parkinson's, I think is a key to maintaining a reasonable relationship as this disease, shows up, sits down and says, "I'm here for the duration."
And I will say that I think that one of the, we talked a little bit about this, how we compartmentalize people of different ages in North America right now. I think that one of the things that might have a cultural tie to this, and I am not the person who would know this, is generally we do revere youth. And ableism, like being ambulatory and able to do things to a freakish level in the United States. Like it's like you, it's like it's not allowed to get old. You're not allowed. And so that puts a lot of pressure on people to resist the situation, on a lot of different levels. Like it's not okay to be old. Okay, so I'm going to ask this. All right, so you talked openly a couple of times about how when you were dating, you were running a conversation in your head that was like, don't, this is not what we want to do, Terry, don't do this, but you still fell in love.
I did.
And I want to talk about whether or not that kind of continued after you were married and committed in this forever relationship. You shared in your pitch that you recognized that Parkinson's disease had changed him so completely that he, in the words you told yourself, had nothing for you. That sounds really hard. When I read that, that sounded like that was a very tough spot for you to be in. Share a little bit about what was happening in day-to-day life, and how that conversation was showing up in your mind and your conversations with him as well.
Well, that was a kind of pivotal day in my caregiving life when I was able to say to myself, "He has nothing for you," because that meant I could stop looking for him to be the husband that I had married, and I could stop looking for him to be the person that his whole life history and his soul had made him. And when that happened, I was able to think differently about what is happening here. What are we here? He lost the ability to do the smallest kind of ordinary moments of engagement. There was a lunar eclipse, and it was in a position where we could look out our bedroom r window and watch the whole thing. And I was so excited about this. In his normal self, he would have been excited right alongside me, and we would have gotten out the binoculars, and it would have been a whole thing. He couldn't find the feeling of caring about that. When I told him I had a scary medical diagnosis, He couldn't find his sense of being able to care about the fact that I had this, what turned out to be not so bad diagnosis. Not because he didn't care, but because he couldn't care.
Right, unable.
Yeah.
So, one of the things that sometimes people say, we talked earlier about people saying things that are not helpful in situations. One of the things sometimes people will say in situations is that they will say, well, they're not able. And it's like, well, then it shouldn't bother you. This shouldn't bother you because you know that the person is unable. And I particularly have never found that to be a supportive comment. I don't know if that's just because I'm a crabby person or whether or not it's a more universal experience. You married you loved him. He was your partner and your support system, and that your relationship changed to not only were you caregiving for him, but you lost your partner.
I did.
What is there? You do not have to answer this, but was there anger, sadness, resentment? What were some of the things in the dark moments of the night? What were some of the things that were really hard there?
Loneliness. It becomes very lonely because you are taking care of someone who you once loved and do love, but your love has to change in some way that I can't describe in a sentence or two. Exhaustion, because the physical demands can be very hard. And we had a very helpful person who took care of a lot of the household stuff. So it's really lucky in that way. Not everybody is that lucky. But exhaustion, loneliness, the sense of feeling cheated. I was so ready to sail that sailboat. I wanted this guy who was a really excellent sailor to teach me stuff I had forgotten, not having sailed for, a lot of years. It was like, oh yeah, I'm so ready for this. And the fact that he couldn't do that, just it was rot. It was rotten. I mean, it wasn't his fault. But when you love someone and you've had them as your other half, to use the expression that we use a lot, your other half, maybe your better half, and then they're gone, but their needs, their illness remains.
Yeah, that's a very okay. So, all right. So we talked a little bit. I'm gonna sort of lighten this up a teeny tiny bit. I'm gonna ask a question that because this is a question that a lot of people are in caregiving relationships. It is a really big group of people, and it's a very hard thing. And I have not ever run across somebody who says, "Oh, caregivers are so well supported." Okay, so that's just a global. It's a great time. Everyone should do it. Okay, so I'm going to ask you a random question, and this is meant to be a lighter question. You can tell me to buzz off. It's inappropriate. I actually have an extended family member who lived at Camp Lejeune, which is a military base, a Marine base. And it's also they run like all these ads, infomercials, because it's embroiled in all these lawsuits and things like that. That's like, for, if you are a family member, lived at Camp Lejeune, join us on this lawsuit and farm this infomercial. And so I don't actually, my question is like, were you peppered with people offering you throughout this experience just wildly inappropriate invitations or solicitations when they found out that you were a caregiver and that your husband or somebody in your house had any kind of affliction?
That I didn't have.
Okay.
Partly that was because we had moved to a new location, 1,000 miles from where we had been. So we didn't have, why we did that, I'm not sure. Well, I know why, because the sailboat was.
The sailboat, you're chasing a dream. I honor that.
Right. But what that meant was that people offered us invitations to dinner once.
Okay.
Right. There was a general, I mean, the community I'd lived in. People were very supportive at an arm's length. But having someone you could call in the middle of the night when he fell, turns out in almost every community in the US, if your loved one falls, you call your EMTs and they do what's called a lift assist. But a lot of people don't know that.
Right. No, I do know that because like I've known people who do it, but I've also been in conversations where somebody would say, can you believe they called 911 when they fell? And I'm the person who says, yes, can you lift a 200-pound person from the floor? You have to call. That's what we do.
And I actually checked with the fire chief in our town, or the chief of the EMTs in our town. He says, please, those are the
Yes.
easy calls. You know, when some guy needs to be picked up off the floor and dusted off, they can do that. And that's the easy, low adrenaline call for them. So I learned to be okay with that. We didn't have to do that much.
But it sounds like you missed or felt a feeling of disenfranchised missing. The close community that you might have had to be able to call somebody who'd known you for 20 or 30 years who would have just driven over and jumped in.
That was not there. That was
Yeah.
not there. And so here's what surprises me when I talk to other caregivers. It's not uncommon that even when you have that extended community, it disappears because they don't know what to say. They don't know how to help. People who've told me this, and I'm sort of stunned by it, how common it is for religious faith communities to disappear.
Yep. I've
And
heard a similar, yeah.
see, but you don't get invited to the events. No one comes to help you. This is not universal, but it's common enough that it makes me upset. If I'd gone to
Yeah.
church for 25 years, and then I would love to come to the Christmas ceremony, but I need somebody to come to be here with him because he can't get around, and no one is there for that.
Yeah, it is a very, very hard thing. And so I think that, if you are in the audience and you are lucky enough to have that very loyal family group that is sticking with you, we see you and honor that it's very, very lucky. And on the flip side, if you don't, it's a place for improvement within
Absolutely.
many communities to try and do the best they can. And the other side of that is I think that all of us can understand, and have live the other side of that, where there are people in our network and we do let them drift off accidentally or just because we're busy and we have other things going on. And so all of those things are true all at the same time.
That's true. That's
Yeah,
true.
all of those things are true all at the same time. What's the time frame that we're talking about here? You describe this as a late in life relationship, and but how long is the time between love at first opera, and when your husband passed away?
It was about 9 years.
How many of those years were joy-filled before caregiving became more of the bulk of the relationship?
I would say the first two-thirds. I recently found a letter he had written to me, and it's like, oh, right, that's why I married you.
Okay.
But then there were other kinds of joy. And this was whatever gifts I've been given in life, I think, are rooted in the fact that I was able to find joy even when it was really hard.
Okay.
He had a very silly streak. And so finding ways to sort of stimulate that and enjoy that helped me wind my way into the moments and the small locations where there was something of joy to be shared.
Very
He,
nice.
opera was just a kind of a weird theme in our life, and there's one particular performance from the Metropolitan Opera that I could practically sing myself because
Beautiful.
people with Parkinson's tend to like to watch the same episode of Gunsmoke or Don Giovanni or whatever, whichever opera it was. What was it? Barbara Seville was the opera that we watched. And because it was familiar, because he knew what was coming, because it was easy for him to understand, watching that became part of a regular afternoon routine for us.
That is another really interesting parallel to life with a toddler, where you watch the same movie 527 times, but again, the toddler phase ends and you move on, and this was a different
Both parents,
trajectory. Yeah.
with typical kids, they grow up and they do something else annoying.
Yeah. They
You
do.
know,
Right, exactly.
and then they turn into lovely people like my kids. Oh.
And that is, I mean, like we were saying before, those milestones, traditional milestones in childhood development, those are celebrated. And when you get to the end of life milestones, it's kind of the opposite. You're watching benchmarks that are signals of,
Grew up.
yeah. Exactly. That's a hard thing. Okay, so you created a beautiful life that you enjoyed with somebody you knew who had a terminal diagnosis, and you were able to live and create connection and community even through the very hard things. Your husband does pass away. That is part of the story, and I hope that was not terribly insensitive the way I threw that
No,
in there.
real.
There are folks in the audience who are in a spot where you were. They are in love and sharing their life with somebody in their family that has a terminal diagnosis. The one you experienced with Parkinson's, we have no way of knowing what other conditions people are going through. What would you want to share with them as somebody who has been where they are? Like, if you were to give one sort of general piece of advice that would have been helpful for you in the middle, what would that be?
Life is a terminal diagnosis.
It is. Yeah, right. There's no prize at the finish line here. That's true.
We don't get out of this without death. And because he and I had talked about end of life things, his passing away was very, it's a strange word to use, but it was intimate and loving and very much an honor for me. And it sounds so saccharine, but it was an honor to be alongside him as he left this life. And in part, that was because we were not pretending that death was not the end of this story.
Yes.
And he knew I would be with him. There was an incident, and I think this really taught me something. We were at a doctor's appointment, and the details are not even important, except that he got very, very agitated in a way that was very scary. And he was yelling at me, and I don't trust you, and all the things that make you want to run and hide. Took a deep breath. And I realized that he needed me not to get agitated when he got agitated. But then I said to him, I'm so sorry that you have to live through this. I wish I could take it away. I can't take it away, but I can promise you that you do not have to face this alone, and I will do everything I can to keep you safe and not in pain. I'll keep you safe and I'll keep you not in pain. And what surprised me was that he went, and all the anger disappeared, and he said, "That's what I want. That's what I want." And that mutuality, I'll be here. I'm not going anywhere, and I will do everything I can to keep you comfortable, gave him a kind of reassurance that made the end of his life, and this was toward the end of his life, it made it loving. Can't say it was fun. It wasn't always fun, but it was close and it was personal.
That is a beautiful lesson. Did you just happen to figure that out in the moment, or was that something that is taught to you? Because I was taught that skill in dealing with people who are agitated, to not confront them about their agitation or ask them why they are agitated, but very much just to say, this feels like you might be going through some hard times right now. Like, I'm here to be with you.
I knew him. I knew him really
Yeah.
well. And so I was able to just tell what was undoing him and
So
what
it was
was.
a natural moment.
Yeah, I mean, I have worked with people in trouble in a lot of different settings.
Okay.
So there was a kind of history in my own life of just sort of knowing how to do stuff like that, as you say.
Yeah.
But I just could see that what did he need? I mean, could I magic away the Parkinson's? No, sure, I
Right.
wouldn't do that. But since I can't, what can I do for you? You won't be by yourself.
Yep. The way you tell the story, it's a beautiful moment. I can imagine that it would be calming. It felt soothing to me, and I'm not even a part of the story to hear it. And so that is very, very good. All right, that was amazing. I love it. After your husband passed away, or as you say, left this life, those are the words you use, you began to do work supporting other Parkinson's disease caregivers. In a minute, we're going to do the final fun questions, but I do want to give you a chance to tell people about the work you do and how people can find you to connect.
Well, I didn't start out to work with other people with Parkinson's. I was going to go to Spain and learn flamenco dancing and play. But I had a book in my head and in my heart. And the question came to me at a, I think it was a yoga retreat. How can you have a loving relationship with someone who has a degenerative disease?
Yep.
And that led to my writing the book, Love, Dignity, and Parkinson's. I love to show it off because I
Yep,
didn't.
there it is. If you're people
Yard.
watching the video, you see it. There you go.
Love, Dignity, and Parkinson's. Because that's what I learned was how to sustain love and how to continue his dignity and mine in the face of Parkinson's. So I wrote the book and I thought I was done. I have to spend, whatever. But then someone said, you need a mailing list. Okay, I made a mailing list. And someone else said, you need a website. So I made a website. And now, 3 years later, I have a community of almost 7,000 caregivers, mostly women, who, I send them a column every week, sort of like Dear Abby, about being a caregiver and other things that I've created. And I have a course for people who are just learning to do this. Because what surprised me and what continues to surprise me is that the resources for caregivers of adults with Parkinson's, with other kinds of dementia, because Parkinson's can often lead to dementia, those resources are not there.
And where they are, they're very expensive and hard to get.
Well, yeah, that's true. But just for ordinary people in ordinary situations to have somebody who says, I understand what you're going through. Here's some things that can help. And it just kind of happened to me. So all of a sudden, I guess I have a business.
Yes, I see it. All right. So that you have a website. Shout out your website so that people can
My
find
name,
you.
terrypease.com,
All right, very
TERRYPEASE.com.
Very good. All right. So you wrote the book, you have the community, you have a special offer for the audience, which is an excerpt from the book you just showed, Love, Dignity, and Parkinson's, from Care Partner to Caregiver. The full book is on Amazon. I will put a link to the full book everywhere this episode is and in the newsletter. And then you can get an excerpt as a special offer for the audience. And the website will also be in all of those places for everybody who is watching and listening. The easiest way to get these links is always to be a subscriber to my email community because then you can click on them. Of course, I'd love to have you be there. I think it's great. You're going to love it. But it is also the easiest way to get the links. I want to thank you for sharing your story and for all that generous information. Are you ready for the final fun questions?
Amy, I am ready.
Let's do it. All right. When you were in middle school or high school,
Oh, dear.
way back when, what do you remember as a fun weekend night activity that you did with friends?
I was a member of a Tri-High Y, which is sort of like
Tell me
nobody's
more.
heard of it, a YMCA-based
Ah.
young people's group organization, and our group is called Aphrodite Tri-High Y. It still exists all these years later, and we just had wonderful weekends, events, going places and hanging out and being kids together.
I love it. Tri-High. I'd never heard of that, but I love it. So through the YMCA, I spent a lot of time at my local YMCA as a kid because I was swimming lessons and camps and all those things. So Tri-High Y. Very good. Okay. So if you, next question, if you won a gargantuan amount of money, like Powerball lottery money, which is bananas, like $600 million or something today. If you win, you take the tax cut, you take it up front, so on and so forth. You still get a huge amount of money. What is the first thing you would buy? And the only rule is that it has to be something that's for you. It can
Ooh,
be an
something.
experience or a thing, but what's something you would buy?
I would buy a particular necklace.
I love it. Something you've had your eye on for a while, like.
I've had my eye on for a while. I have a, I'm not able to wear non-precious metal, so I
Okay.
don't wear jewelry for the most part. I'm, my Apple Watch, because I can't. And so I would buy myself a gold necklace that I could actually wear.
Beautiful. I love that. And you would enjoy it. All right. Very good. All right. So we are recording this right before the winter gift giving holidays. It's coming out in the winter in February. But this, what is something that you would enjoy getting as a gift this year? And here's the rule. It has to be a thing that can be purchased, right? It can't be like love or joy or world peace. It can be something small. It can be something small or something that you would enjoy if somebody gave you as a gift this year.
It's again, it's very silly. It would be a really good pair of castanets and lessons to learn how to use them.
I love it. All right, so you have it on your to-do list to do the flamenco lessons and the castanets and all of those things. This is something that is in your future. I think that's going to happen sooner than you think. All right. Thank you for sharing. That's it. Terry Pease, thank you for being a wonderful guest today on the show.
Thank you for inviting me, Amy.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, Subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. I'd be again. Please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adultier adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.